little phallic. All filmed in the garage, which was picked up. Was supposed to be done. And this is a short film excerpt of the larger history block. Took a lot of years to get this. And it's a very dramatic, heated tale. He calls himself Humble.
For Disney, nature carries the male voice of reproduction and the nuclear family, not the what I fear, the relative size of things in the universe that John articulated. Already in Charles Urban's treatise on the cinematograph and science education in the state, where, quote, cinematography teaches that the more we study by means of modern methods, the more the student is struck by the almost human-like instincts of the plants under observation. Phenomena of plant life, which take several days or a week to record, can be projected on the screen, condensed to a single film, as if the successive stages follow each other in the course of a few minutes. Walt Disney, apparently as a child, also thought long and hard about plants and the life of squirrels. As Greg Mittman writes in his fascinating account, Real Nature, America's Romance with Wildlife on Film, Disney told one of his colleagues how he loved to observe squirrels for hours at his desert home. To me, he states, they have personalities just as distinct and varied as humans. The true life adventure suffused nature with a morality that universalized the institution of nuclear family, revealing the hand of God omnipresent throughout the animal kingdom, also reveling in the spirit of industrialization itself. So we move far away from the individual animal personalities, and we move more into the framework of a larger universalism. This is spelled out for all to see in the children's book publication of Nature's Half Acre, another true life adventure. And this book was published by Singer for educational use, photographs by John Nash Ott and others, where we read that the little land of the animals is nothing other, this is my interpretation, than a city symphony. Quote, down in the grasses lies a busy land. It has millions of inhabitants. It has crowded cities and quiet homes. It has busy highways with travelers hurrying up and down. It has wars and weddings, factories and farms. It has all the excitement of our bigger world and all its dangers, too. This is the world of the insects. This anthropocentric reading of nature hammered in through Disney narration was, however, banned from the image in a directive sent to nature photographers interested in selling footage for the adventure series. The Disney studio emphasized that there must be no evidence of civilization or man's work in the picture. That Disney naturalist photographers like Ott with his dancing primroses are torn between their desire to bring a realism recreation of wildlife to their audience and the need to fabricate a more intense drama to elicit thrills and commercial success. Long before the time of Microcosmos and Herzog's Grizzly Man, Ott, for example, asks this question, how does nature speak to technological modernity? I am not only speaking of the fact that he refused to make a film on one fertilizer that he believed did not work. Ott, in his personal meanderings on film, his autobiographical Exploring the Spectrum, expresses concern that aphids in a field that borders on an air traffic control area seem to shudder or perform a dance when they register the far-off voice of sonar equipment. The use of time-lapse photography brings with it, once again, a satellite awareness of world events, nature, a voice we heard yesterday in the telephonic operator. So nature, again, mirrors his voice. The second clip, please. So it starts off this is a little micro-cinematography experiment on pollen and nasal secretion. Thank you. Seemingly insignificant creatures, aphids, are vivified through the revealing power, the magnifying power of the lens. The corpse or inanimate fabric of life even prior to the 1895 invention of cinema, is a primary subject of concern and interest in the area of the microscopic treatise. And here I wanted to give a quote by scientific historian William B. Carpenter. He contemplates the revealing power of the lens when considering the educational value of the microscope and how it relates to the uncanny equation of nature, technology, and modernity. Already in the mid-19th century, Carpenter articulates the microscopic examination, the microscopic picture, as amusement and education intertwined, a neo-romantic journey that vivifies the world and its secrets and inspires, quote, a love of nature in the city dweller, whose range of vision had become dull and limited. Adventure, the voyage, teeming life already in the 1850s are the coordinates in this micrographic trip that promises multiplicity and natural world excursions inscribed within the hectic sphere of the metropolis. Extended quote here. What can be a more effectual means of turning such opportunities to the best account than the employment of an aid which not only multiplies almost infinitely the sources of interest presented by the objects with which our eyes are most familiar, but finds inexhaustible life where all seems dead, constant activity where all seems motionless, perpetual change where all seems inert. Turn, on the other hand, to the young who are growing up in our great towns in the heart of the vast metropolis, whose range of vision is limited on every side by bricks and mortar, who rarely see a green leaf or a fresh blade of grass, and whose knowledge of animal life is practically limited to the dozen or two of creatures that everywhere attach themselves to the companionship of man and shape their habits by his. To attempt to inspire a real love of nature by books and pictures, and those who have never felt her influences, is almost hopeless. A child may be interested by accounts of her wonders, as by any other instructive narrative, but they have little of life or reality in his mind, far less than has the story of adventure, which appeals to his own sympathies, or even the fairy tale, which charms and fixes his imagination. Here the microscope may be introduced with all the more advantage, as being almost the only means accessible under such circumstances for supplying what is needed. A single rural or even suburban walk may afford stories of pleasurable occupation for weeks in the examination of its collected treasures. A large glass jar may be easily made to teem with life in almost as many and as varied forms as could be found by the unaided eye in long and toilsome voyages over the wide ocean. And a never-ending source of amusement is afforded by the observation of their growth, their changes, their movements, their habits. The schoolboy thus trained looks forward to the holiday, which will enable him to search afresh in some favorite pool or to explore the wonders of some stagnant basin with as much zest as the keenest sportsman. His excursion is only the beginning of a fresh stock of enjoyment instead of being in itself the whole, end quote. Foregrounded in Carpenter's text is the idea that it is difficult to observe well in the hurried metropolis, which has overwhelmed our vision with sensory impressions. Carpenter writes that the modern observer is tempted to, quote, take in everything at a glance, not to focus vision, but to disperse and scatter it. The microscope, he postulates, is an antidote to this dulled and scattered vision of the metropolis. It ushers in a scientific voyage in the midst of urbanity, and it also focuses free time, giving the observer the contours of imaginary travel and heightened vision to replace the dry mortar and sunless corners and ennui of the city. It makes productive those hours which, quote, might otherwise be passed in frivolous or degrading amusements, and finally leads to an ought-like contemplation of scale, convincing us that size is but relative, and that, quote, mass has nothing to do with real importance. The microscope and magic lantern turn the living room into a pre-Disney laboratory where one can contemplate wonders of the natural world. In the 20s, Laszlo Moholy-Nagy will come to similar conclusions about the magnifying power of the microscope as an antidote to the mind-numbing shock of modernity. Again, this is couched within the rhetoric of sensory discovery. The microscope and microphotography, argues Moholy-Nagy, disclose a new world. They reveal in this age of haste and superficiality the marvel of the smallest units of construction, our substitute for the longer period of time that primitive man could devote to observation. Moholy-Nagy's politics of photography in the Bauhaus aims to rework ennui, prioritizing leisure and observation over haste. He argues that microphotography gives the hurried person of today a stimulus to more leisurely observation of the object itself. And so finally, in concluding this panel, I want to open up the discussion with a series of questions. What is time lapse? What does it create? If time lapse, if we are to in fact have a subject of time lapse, how do we tease out the subject? And for Ott, time lapse is a corrective. It's a social corrective. It's also disease and in medical film. It's always a corrective. So what is it correcting if we go back to the microscope, et cetera? I'm just throwing these questions up. Okay, so that's it. Thanks.